The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Hyundai, Ireland's fastest growing car brand. Join the Hyundai revolution. The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Hyundai. Everyone's talking about the revolution driven by Hyundai, Ireland's fastest growing car brand.
Hello there, and a very good morning to you. And you're very welcome indeed to the programme this morning. And let me tell you, if you're interested in whistleblowers and ministers for justice and Gardaí and cops in crisis and all of that kind of stuff, and there's loads of it in the papers today. The Sunday Times, Garda tapes confirm Ian Bailey fit up. They have very extensive coverage on that in the Sunday Times today. Judge sorry for slur on Muslims, and Sinn Féin surges in popularity as Labour bears brunt of scandals. The Minister for Justice is on the front page, his photograph is on the front page of the Sunday Business Post, with coalition support slumps after justice scandals. Vast bulk of the IBRC 22 billion loan book is to be offloaded, and Beaumont closes kidney transplant list, which I'd say is very worrying for many. Sunday Independent, Callanan, my shock that Enda shafted me. Callanan's closest associates say late night visit forced him to quit. Shatter could face fine over Wallace prime time leak. So that's the coverage in those. Now, the Mail also does very extensive coverage on the main stories, so to speak. They go big with the Bailey tapes. There's more on the missing flight story as well, with quotes from daughter and wife to say that one of the pilots had been distraught because of the breakdown of his marriage. The Mirror lead with shame of Ireland Bay laws. This relates to an interview with a man whose son was murdered 17 years ago and is calling for our Bay laws to be changed. And the Sunday World continue with more on Patrick Nulty, but they also are covering the main story as is covered in every paper today, cops in crisis. Now, with us in studio this morning are James McGill, barrister, Richard Moore, former government advisor to Dermot Ahern in particular, so that was justice, Harry McGee, political correspondent with the Irish Times, Catherine McGuinness, retired judge and former senator, and Paul Williams, special correspondent with the Irish Independent, and you are all very welcome. Now, Richard Moore, I presume whoever is doing your job now will be going through those papers with a fine tooth comb.
I'd say they'll probably be exhausted. They're probably up since about 6 o'clock this morning, but they probably bought them the night before as well, which when I was in that job, it was something I tended to do myself. Was, if you happen to be privileged to live in Dublin, you can get the Sunday papers on a Sunday night. So it's there's a phenomenal amount of coverage about the story. It's obviously the single biggest crisis, I think, to hit the government since they've come into power. It's not, may not be over yet, because there's going to be commissions and reports coming back at the Minister and the Department of Justice towards the end of, in the next 4 or 5 weeks, so mm-hmm. in the timeline up to Easter. So I think there's a, you know, it depends on what's in those reports, but it's been a very tough week for the government, and I suppose it's been a very tough week for the Minister, and, you know.
And I would have thought for the Commissioner.
Exactly. I mean, yeah. It's for the Commissioner to retire or resign or whatever. There's extensive coverage in the papers as to the circumstances in which he departed. And I mean, I think there'd be a popular view in all the papers that the figures of the bottle of whiskey and the revolver at the doorbell was probably, I think the number was up. And I think you have a situation as well, where you have a situation where he had to withdraw his remarks. I know Martin Callanan, and he's a very fine policeman. I think it would have maybe stuck in his craw a bit to have to withdraw the remarks. Apparently, some papers are suggesting that he went to do so, but the Department of Justice asked him not to.
Asked him not to, and then they have said not so.
Yeah, that's right. I'm not too sure, but there's no doubt that there was a logjam there, because Labour once Leo Varadkar the previous week entered the fray. From the point of view of a government advisor, when you think your story is parked, and the story had been parked, There's no doubt about that. It had been sorted out in the sense that, but that there was, it wasn't going anywhere. But when the Minister for Transport, Leo Varadkar, entered the frame and suggested that it would be helpful if the Commissioner withdrew his remarks, that ignited the whole issue again. And obviously, Labour were then forced to come out and agree with Leo Varadkar.
Right.
I'd say, and the Kenny must have been furious. So then you have a situation where that the Commissioner essentially had to withdraw his remarks. And then that would then pave the way for the Minister for Justice to apologise. But that, so, but I think there was an issue there, and I think that the issue was that Labour had to, that the Commissioner essentially, I suppose, had to go in a sense. Because
if you were advising the Minister now, as you were when Dermot Aharon was there, what would you be advising him to do?
At the moment?
Yeah.
That's a tricky one. Well, I say, to be honest with you, Minister Shatter my own view is that ministers for justice have to be tough. And I think the public like their ministers for justice to be tough. And I worked for a minister for justice who was fairly robust. I think Alan Shatter is somewhat similar style. He's a kind of a robust style. I think the difference would have been is that he appears to enjoy, maybe enjoy is the wrong word, but he seems to be quite happy to allow something to continue over a protracted period of time. I think this issue with the apology, with the Commissioner's remarks, should have been sorted out 6, 7, 8 weeks ago. Mm. But they seem to be happy to let it run on and run on.
Possibly not realising the consequences?
Well, the danger about that is once you let something bubble away underneath the surface, yeah, you never know what's going to emerge to up the ante in the story. And I think it should have been sorted out maybe 2 months ago. But instead, for whatever reason, they allowed it to run on.
James McGill, what stood out for you in the coverage?
Well, I suppose that a bit disappointing is that people haven't really broken it down into its constituent parts. I mean, the fact of improper Garda conduct in relation to listening in on conversations, whether they're between lawyers and clients or whether they're just members of the public phoning in or whatever it would be, has gone on for decades. So that really isn't an of-the-now political issue, I would have thought. Mm. The of-the-now political issue is how this should be dealt with. And clearly the establishment of a commission to examine this is the correct way to go. And
yeah, I was thinking about this, and recordings or no recordings, I would have thought that having a conversation between somebody who's charged and a solicitor in a Garda station would be highly inadvisable one way or the other. I wouldn't have expected that it would be confidential enough.
Yeah, I think what you'll find is,
I think his solicitor would be an idiot, would have thought, you know.
I think what routinely you'll find is, if there are the tapes of the conversations, that the conversation would start with you talking to me, and I would say straight away, Marion, say nothing to me over the phone. I would be into the station and we will have a discussion then. And even then, you wouldn't be sure the discussion would be completely private. But, I mean, quite an amount of people are not particularly experienced. They're in a stressful situation and they do say things. And a good example would be the young person who's brought into custody, and they say, oh, the one thing I'm worried about is my father hearing about this. Now, the very next thing that could happen is the police commence the next interview by taking the guy into the corridor and saying, if you don't cooperate, we'll be on the phone to your father, because they know where the pressure point is.
Right.
So therefore, it's not likely that the detail of a case will be discussed, but some personal pressure point of the detained person might very well emerge in those short phone calls and could be abused. Mm. And there are far more serious examples. But I do think that people are unrealistic if they think that phone calls between lawyers and suspects in Garda stations will have detailed case analysis. That will not be the case. I think you'd be fairly confident of that. But it is nonetheless improper, and in some of the cases, that improper conduct will have led to unfair results. Mm.
Catherine McGuinness, what do you think of the coverage?
Well, it certainly is absolutely all over all the papers. Mm. But we're left with a situation where, as James has said, it isn't really broken down into the separate parts. I mean, it seems to me that the issue of the whistleblowers and the tapes and the apologies is one bit, and the issue of the recording of the tapes is a completely different bit. But the extraordinary part about it is the vast unknowingness, particularly about the tapes issue, that nobody seems to have known that it was going on, which seems to me to be quite extraordinary. For instance, during the week, the Irish Times had details of the tender for the digitalisation of it, which happened in 2008 during the reign of the previous government, and it must have been, although a figure wasn't given, it must have been a large figure who signed off on the bill for this? I mean, who paid the telephone bills for all this recording?
Yeah, yeah.
And then everybody says, well, we didn't know what was going
on. And yet others said that there was a tag on some of the phones to say this is the one that's tapped and that's the one that's tapped, you know.
That's true. And also the same person who said that in an interview that I heard, who was one of the Gardaí who were involved in the communications end of things, said that the recordings were on a loop tape and that it just went round and round. And I mean, I certainly can remember my late husband suggesting that all our telephone calls were tapped at an earlier stage when the heavy gang was in business,
right?
And that we should be very careful about what we said even on our home phones. But
well, just you and the Attorney General and the Taoiseach, I mean, if they can't have a private conversation. Paul, this was a fairly rough week, I would have thought, for the Gardaí and for kind of as a word trust in the Gardaí.
I think it's taken a life, to say it's taken on a life of its own is probably putting it mildly. I think I agree with James. And going back to the coverage today, it has left people absolutely confused, at least. The ordinary punter on the street, the people themselves. I was talking to, when this announcement came out on Tuesday, I rang a person at assistant commissioner level and I said, what's the story with this? And he was saying, I don't know about phones. He said, I would be concerned about my own phone if I was ringing into a station. Nobody wants to be taped.
Systematically.
But there is, and as James says, there's a lot of stuff about it today. It's wall to wall. Is it, number one, what my understanding is that the 999 calls, they were called C&D, command and dispatch rooms, in each major division of Garda station. The 999 calls are taped, and they're routinely taped everywhere because obviously they're used for evidence later and various other inquiries. That at some stage that these calls then would appear that they were switched over at night when the command and dispatch room was closed down to a sergeant's office or whatever. And then it would appear, but again, it's not made clear anywhere by anybody yet, that perhaps other conversations were caught in the trawl or the net, but you know, maybe conversations between solicitors and their clients. But the only specifics that I've seen so far, the Sunday Times claimed that, for example, that there were 8 calls inadvertently recorded between May and June of 1997 between a Garda and a vagrant called Martin Graham, in return for allegedly gathering incriminating evidence against Ian Bailey, the suspect in the Sophie Desconte Plantier case.
The allegation being that there were drugs offered.
That he was offered drugs or stuff, I think it's referred to.
Yeah.
You know, is that what has exercised the Taoiseach? Because there was also earlier on, and again, you know, I'm in the sphere and I can't get an answer on it from anybody, but is it... when he mentions tribunals, is there something there that he maintains could have affected, for example, the Smiddic tribunal? That was a divisional headquarters. There were taping calls in those. Now, you had a different view on that, James, earlier. Maybe there is, maybe there isn't, I don't know. Because on one hand, this could be really, really serious. Or number two, is this a Machiavellian trick? Is this a stunt? And like everybody, but that's the whole thing. Everybody in the lack of coherent answers or explanations, conspiracy theories abound, and that's why obviously a commission of inquiry is so important to try and get to the bottom of this. And why raise it now? Like, it's a bit like the Section 29 warrant that was sitting there after Moriarty, the Morris Tribunal. They said this warrant is defective or is potentially defective, and they left it there under their noses, the legislators, the civil servants, the Gardaí, and then they had this huge shock when the Supreme Court ruled it out, that it was repugnant to the Constitution, and as a result of that, a lot of people walked free and left our prison, and probably a lot more people left over the Section 29 warrant as will leave over this particular controversy. But it was under their noses and they didn't do anything about it. And the attitude seems to be then, prevailing attitude has always been, well, if it's not making any noise or it's not causing us any grief, let's move away from it.
Yeah.
Because going back to civil servants making decisions, it's not in their culture.
Harry, Harry
well,
McGee?
Paul referred to wall-to-wall coverage, and oftentimes in here you hear about wall-to-wall coverage in some newspapers, but it's wall-to-wall coverage, roof-to-ceiling, roof, the garden, the fence, divil and all.
Yes.
It's impossible almost to read anything else in it this morning, but it seems to me that there were two distinct threads in terms of the way in which the story is covered. In terms of the new facts, and Paul referred to the story in the Sunday Times that John Mooney and Mark Tighe had this morning in relation to the Ian Bailey case. There's a story as well in the Sunday Business Post about Dundalk Garda Station and this possibility that somebody forewarned Mickey McKevitt back in 1990 about a raid on his house. Now, that assertion was made by a former inspector, and it was fiercely contested by his colleagues at the time. But politicians during the week were raising the possibility that perhaps one or more tribunals was affected by this revelation. And I presume that there may have been something in existence that wasn't handed over when an order of discovery was made. But a lot of the facts, a lot of the new facts that we have this morning relate to the, say, the criminal side of it as such. And there's also, as the other guests have said, there are so many gaps and so many lacunae about, say, the legal basis, how many of these tapes were made, what protocols were in place, if any. And I suppose the Commission of Investigation will answer all of those. I mean, it seems to me, just as a layperson looking at it, that if one wanted to catch a 999 call or a bomb threat or a coded warning coming in from a paramilitary organisation, I think that to do it efficiently, you'd have to have some kind of automatic system in place rather than having somebody press a record button as soon as the call comes
press
in.
Play.
So to me, there could be a basis, but I don't know if there's a legal basis to allow such a practice. But the difficulty is the retention of such data. And the second difficulty, because it has been reported that the calls that were made from Garda stations were recorded. And to me, it just seems that there is definitely a difficulty with that from the get-go, especially if it involved privileged conversations between lawyers and their solicitors.
Conversations between Gardaí and Gardaí.
Between Gardaí and Gardaí,
well,
yes.
The Gardaí themselves are clearly quite nervous about the fact that their own conversations are being taped.
Yeah.
And while, I mean, it's relatively simple to say the issue is between a solicitor and client conversation, which is clearly legally privileged and cannot be used. Mm. But a lot of questions arise about, was it a conversation recorded? Was it listened to? Was it used in evidence? Was it in the... We did it form part of the investigation, but was not used in evidence? I mean, there's a whole lot of separate questions about it. And the thing is that we really don't know, but everyone seems to be agreed that what has sort of set the ball going in this, in the recording controversy, is the Bailey case. And that's the coincidence that it happened just at the time when the adjournment for discovery came to an end and it was necessary to discover it. And I think if you look back on that case, you have to remember that Eamon Barnes, when he was DPP, and Eamon Barnes was a very careful man and not given to making public statements, that he very publicly rejected the Garda file against Mr. Bailey when it was sent to him to prosecute. And I mean, it's a case that has created these problems about evidence and the behaviour of the Gardaí all along.
Right.
But I mean, we can't but hope that the end of all this will be that they will move ahead with the kind of reforms that are needed in regard to setting up a Gardaí body and so on.
They've been talking about that, though, since,
well, exactly,
you know,
but it takes something. It usually takes some sort of dreadful crisis to push people on to actually do something.
You want to come in there, Harry?
Yeah, well, I mean, Catherine referred to Gardaí conversations, and the Waterford case involved Gardaí to Gardaí conversations, and it was the trial judge ruled in that case that those conversations were not admissible in evidence because at least one of the parties, must consent, and neither of the parties knew nor consented to the phones being recorded. And that was the first flag that was raised in relation to this issue. And one of the questions the Commission of Investigation, I presume, will look into is to why those flags weren't noticed, first of all, by the Attorney General's Office, by the Gardaí, by GSOC, by reporters and by the Department of Justice and the political class. The second element of the coverage this morning is the political element, and that seems to be more in the sphere of opinion. And it is again asking the question that's been asked about Alan Shatter for the past 6 or 7 weeks. Is he going to survive this crisis, and is his position untenable? And you have the likes of Owen Harrison, Sunday Independent, and Tom McGurk both arguing that his position in the Sunday Business Post, arguing that his position is untenable. It seems to me that at this moment in time, he seems to be perhaps one crisis short of the plank being put out and him asked to walk along length of some.
Well, I mean, he's lucky in this sense in that the Labour Party really like him, and they like the kind of work that he's been doing. So one has to presume, therefore, that it's not going to, or should one, that it's not going to destabilise the government.
Well, I think the Martin Callanan became the sacrificial lamb this week, and I mean, all the evidence seems to point to that he was effectively sacked by the government. I mean, the government sent a senior, in an unprecedented move, sent the most senior civil servant in the Department of Justice to explain to him the quote mark gravity, close quote mark, of the situation. And it certainly it seemed to me that once Martin Callanan heard that information, there was only one course of action that he could follow. So I think that will have given the government and Alan Shatter some degree of protection for the moment. I think the Labour Party will protect him, but they'll only protect him to a certain degree. It might become a moment when that becomes so non-reactive.
I presume you know Martin Callanan, do you? I mean, he really was the sacrificial... Well, he appears to have been the sacrificial lamb. Here I see Owen Harris writing about put not your trust in princes, you know, because last week we were told they were joined at the hip, and this week there ain't no joint at the hip.
No, the main story in the Sunday Independent is Callanan, my shock that ended the shaft at me. That obviously is coming directly from Martin Callanan himself. And there was also stuff in the story about this to this effect earlier in the week with Tom Brady in the Irish Independent and Paul Reynolds. And, you know, he obviously is saying very clearly that when Brian Purcell arrived, as Richard
was
saying, the proverbial gun and the whiskey,
yeah,
to say that people, that the Taoiseach was concerned about this, it was a signal for him to go, and he decided to go. He probably regrets that he took the extension that he did some time ago. So he was obviously...
he should have gone in the,
he was due to retire
on the age basis.
And he got an extension, so he did.
But so... When he arrived, he decided, well, there's nothing left for me here. So why did the Taoiseach get involved in this directly? Why did he send Brian Purcell out? Is it part of a conspiracy to completely and spectacularly distract us from other issues? Are they that clever? I don't know. But when Brian Purcell arrived at his house, it's very, very obvious that Callanan was basically knew he was finished at that stage.
What kind of effect will that have on the other guards?
It'll have a major effect on the other guards. I think the guards themselves will be furious that they have lost one of their own. They're a tight-knit bunch, as Paul would know. The senior management and the guards, I think they would be absolutely livid that the commissioner was essentially sacrificed, as they would see it, for political expediency. It'll, I think it'll have reverberations down the line. Just going back to, I mean, the other issue about Martin Callanan is that if you look at what exactly he did in terms of the taping of the phone calls or the practice that was going on.
Upon it,
Like once it came to, he did stop the phone call, he did stop the taping. He sent in letters. He appeared to have carried out his duties correctly.
It would appear.
And then I was curious as well. I mean, this commission of investigation, I actually don't believe for one. I mean, obviously the Bailey case is very serious. But in terms of all these other possible ramifications down the line, I'd listen very carefully what Catherine had to say in terms of evidence and what you can, if you have a recording of a phone call, you have to introduce it into evidence and all this kind of thing. So I actually don't think the implications, maybe I'm wrong, for the state are that major in terms of other proper other possible cases. And the Commission of Investigation, I think it was Brian Dowling of RTE, I heard him during the week on the radio, and I thought he made an interesting point where he basically said that the Commission Investigation was the fastest commission or tribunal ever set up in the history of the state. It was set up within about 48 hours. They, like, it was just whipped out of a suitcase on the Monday, and, you know, lo and behold, we have a Commission of Investigation. So it'll have important work, but I just wonder, is there how much is out there in terms of its the impact of taping phone calls.
Because there was a kind of a suggestion, you know, that the prison gates would be opened and murderers and rapists would stalk the land. I presume that's complete exaggeration.
Well, I think that is an exaggeration. I mean, that what is more likely to happen, I think, is that there'd be a lot of delay and kind of general messing around, if I might put it informally,
yeah.
Of issues being raised in various cases that are going to delay them. I mean, we saw already Judge Butler had to adjourn a case while it was investigated. It had already been proved that the guard the stations involved in that case did not have the recording equipment, but he had to adjourn it so that perhaps a physical kind of look over those stations to make sure that it was true that they didn't have recording equipment had to be done. But I'd say there would be quite a lot of applications by people, but I don't necessarily, I don't feel that there'd be hordes of murderers and rapists allowed out in this
James?
Situation.
Oh, no, I think I agree. I mean, the
like, I just wonder, are there scare tactics going on? Because it's, you know, you look one way and you see something, then there's a smoke screen and is it political? Is it real? Is it not real? Is it Machiavellian? I mean, that's part of the problem.
Well, it sells a lot of newspapers, obviously.
And we all love a conspiracy theory.
Of course, yes.
But I think the reality of it is as follows, that, I mean, cases that are still in the system, they've yet to be tried. I mean, this would be a routine enough investigation as to whether there has been proper release of information held by the prosecuting authority. So I don't see that there would be great delays. This is an extra layer, but it will be, you know, the trials will proceed as scheduled. Where the greater difficulty will be is in relation to cases that have concluded, but they were concluded in the absence of this important information, which potentially would expose an unfairness. So there will have to be a look back at cases like that. Some of them are going to be clearly very urgent if people are still in custody, some of them less so. And that really turns on how quickly the commission is going to be established so that they can put a shape on this, so that we can find out whether Acting Commissioner O'Sullivan will be able to identify those cases fairly quickly. But to me, one of the concerns would be the monodimensional way that the tapes appear to have been gathered. Namely, if it helps us, we retain it. And if it doesn't help us, we simply record over it. So that's going to be quite hard to get to the bottom of. Because, again, you see that, it's not necessarily that the information recorded would be an admission of guilt or the reverse. But there could be information that either would undermine the prosecution, support the defence, or give a lead to either of those two objectives. So it's quite a sophisticated exercise you have to engage in as to what the information was held by the prosecuting authority and not released to the affected parties.
Right.
And, you know, that is a serious thing. It does warrant all the reaction that it's had, but it shouldn't be scaremongering. It is a serious abusive process by the state and its agents. And if a single person was wrongly convicted, that is a disgrace. Mm.
Can I ask you a real layperson's question? If you are charged with something, do you tell your solicitor if you did it or your barrister when you talk about admission of liability?
Well, first of all, Maureen, you have caused a few people to choke on their boiled egg this morning. Because I've never accepted the honour of being a barrister, quite happy to be a solicitor. And what, again, the media fail, I think, necessarily to understand, and it's probably our fault as solicitors if we don't make this clear, we have a professional obligation to assist the client in dealing with the difficulty that they're in the best possible way. And that often involves establishing the facts and advising a client that their best interests are to plead guilty. So routinely we would have discussions with people in which they would declare that they're guilty and happy to plead guilty and deal with the case on the best way. And
but supposing I admitted liability to you in a privileged conversation, and then I said, no, you must be joking, I want to plead not guilty, I don't want to go to prison.
Yeah, well, there are two elements of every crime. There's the intentional side and the physical act side. And you may very well have committed the physical act, but without the mental intent. And therefore, saying to me an event happened isn't necessarily the same as accepting legal responsibility. Secondly, every citizen is entitled to have the state prove the case against them. What we are not entitled to do is to permit you to give evidence to say you are innocent of an offence, that you have declared that you've participated and committed. So therefore, it's simply a matter, and this is a
question. But I mean, you can go ahead. If I have told you that I did it,
yeah.
But I'm not going to give evidence.
Mm-hmm.
I can plead not guilty, even though you know I did it because I told you.
Because all you're doing is saying to the state, my client is entitled to have the evidence against him produced in court to see that there's guilt. I mean, in some systems, the civil law systems, for instance, the Netherlands is a good example, it is not permitted to plead guilty because of historically the extent of abuse where people were wrongly pressurised into pleading guilty where there was no corroborating independent evidence. And in our jurisdiction, we have a pretty unhappy experience with confessions. So therefore, it's not in fact a bad thing that people are entitled to see the state prove their case in a proper forensic way.
Right. And for barristers?
You aren't really supposed to... if somebody tells you that they are guilty, you must advise them to plead guilty. But it's possible to... I mean, the barrister is kind of at a certain distance from the client because the solicitor is there and has dealt with all this to begin with.
Mm.
But generally speaking, you might avoid asking them to actually say, but if they say they are guilty, you should advise them to plead guilty. But
and if they say no, yes, thank you,
I'd say you'd have to walk away. You'd have to.
Yes, supposed to ask them to get the another get barrister.
All right.
Yes,
yeah.
But I think in all of this, you have to remember that a very large number of cases end in a guilty plea. I think, you know, when people envisage criminal trials, they have a kind of a feeling that everyone is fighting a tooth and nail. Oh. That isn't true. There's a very high proportion of cases in which guilty pleas are entered.
That reminds me of a story I heard many years ago of a very eminent senior counsel who represented a gentleman in a very nasty sex abuse case or whatever. And afterwards, he got off and he went to his senior counsel and he said, I just want you to know, really, I didn't do this. And he said, I am paid to represent you, not to like you, sir. And he told him to, in other words, he didn't really believe his client, but he said, he didn't want to know about it.
It's just that when you talk about these privileged conversations on the phone, like I can't imagine anybody being foolish enough, but I mean, maybe they are, but I can't imagine a professional who knows about these things, like the solicitor in question, having that kind of a conversation on a phone into a Garda station.
Not if you can help it, certainly.
I think you'll find that the solicitors involved will be discouraging those sort of conversations. Mm. Some people will be either so intoxicated or on drugs or under such pressure they may blurt things out. And from time to time, you always got the sensation that certain police would try and seduce you into a wholly improper, unprofessional conversation by putting somebody up to say, would you ever tell granny to throw out the rotten tomatoes, being code for to tell somebody to dispose of drugs that might otherwise be found in the search. So you are always alert to that being a risk.
Right.
But I mean, no competent solicitor would encourage somebody to have a discussion on a sensitive matter over the phone.
But none of that material, obviously, from what you're saying, none of that material, James, would be admissible.
Well, no, they would never disclose it to you because they didn't want you to know, rather than suspect, that the conversations were being listened to. But it's not good enough that you don't tell somebody of material that you're not using, because the material that's not of use to you may be of use to the defence, because it may be consistent with innocence. And, I mean, a substantial number of people undoubtedly plead guilty in circumstances where there is nothing to support their version. And if there was material that does support their version improperly withheld by the prosecuting authorities, that is a serious concern.
Right. OK, by the way, Ian Bailey wants to take issue with the fact that he was referred to as a suspect earlier in the show. He says he was never a true suspect. So that's from him. Let me come back to the politics of all of this, if I may, Harry. Are we where we are because of Enda's loyalty to those who stood by him in the heave? Or is that a very simplistic way of looking at it?
It is a simplistic way, but perhaps it's also an accurate way of describing it. I think if you look at the way in which both sides lined up in that June 2010 leadership contest, you'll find that those who are closest to Enda in that contest, he's remained most loyal to them. I mean, James Riley and Alan Shatter stood steadfastly behind him when others tried to heave against him in 2010. And both James Riley and Alan Shatter have been involved in their fair share of controversies since this government came to power in March 2011. And questions have been asked about the tenability of both ministers.
Yeah.
But never once has Enda Kenny wavered in terms of his support for both ministers.
Sunday Business Post's headline, Shatterproof Fine Gael Loyalties. I mean, he just holds firm. Mm. And even when the Minister for Health was coming in for a lot of criticism, not an inch.
Yeah, but in this particular controversy, I mean, the problem that Shatter has is that there have been so many controversies that have preceded this, that this is just another cut in the 1,000 cuts that politicians are meant to suffer before they fall on their sword and what have you. But in this particular instance, I mean, he isn't really as much to blame as some have been making him out to be. That GSOC report from last June, you would have had to have been pretty quick on the uptake to ascertain something from it that had wider implications. They referred
and
to it.
And he made the point, which is fair enough. The media didn't pick up on it either.
The media didn't.
Nor
did GSOC make a big issue of it. They raised a flag, but it wasn't a flashing flag. And it related just to one Gorda station and not to a widespread practice
Waterford,
in other Gorda stations. And then, I mean, there were extenuating circumstances in relation to, I mean, I think when one looks at why he didn't learn about it between March the 11th and March 24th, 25th, you would have to go back. There were extenuating circumstances, including a bereavement within the department, which don't justify it, but give a certain amount of explanation. So,
and also, in fairness to the minister, the letter was addressed to the Secretary General. Now, it did have the opening line saying, please bring this to the attention of the minister. But I got the impression from the material I'd read is that they were waiting, biding their time until such time as they probably put together a dossier to give to him, you know, so there may be a plausible reason there.
It goes back to what Richard was saying at the start, said his confrontational nature and he loves to goad his opponents and he just can't say stop. He just can't let an argument rest. And that antagonises his opponents and it gets him into trouble. I mean, there are times when it is better just to be silent and to stop and just let things rest. Yes. Unfortunately, he just doesn't seem to have the DNA to allow him to do so.
Yes, well, right enough, yes. I mean, obviously, I have known Alan Shatter for many years. I would have had to have... I worked in the same area as him. And, I mean, what Harry is saying is very true. I listened to the statement that he made in the Dáil in my home, and he seemed to be going along fine, just setting his set, but he could not resist, like poking a wasp's nest with a stick, saying things about the media and saying things about the opposition and so on. And I was sitting there sort of thinking, oh, Alan, stop. Don't do that, you know.
I know.
Some ministers suffer from the... they can't pass a dog without giving it a kick, you know. It's an enduring quality in some respects.
Yet you do have to remember, and I think this is very relevant to the Labour Party people, you do have to remember what a lot of good work that he has done and how that he's on, well, as far as I'm concerned, on the right side in so many things. I mean, I heard an interview with Fergus Finlay about this when it first arose, and he said, well, selfishly, he wanted Alan to continue in office because he wanted to see the legislation about families and children and so on finished. And the difficulty is, I'd say that a number of people would fear that another minister, not so much that they would change track completely because it's government policy, but that they wouldn't push the things so much as Mr. Shatter does. And we all know that things that even when they're government policy, it can be very slow to get legislation pushed through the Houses of the Oireachtas if you're not really sitting there pushing it all the time. So that I'd say that there's an element of that in it, that he gets support because people think he does good work. And he has in regard to prisoners and so on, you know, as well.
I mean, there's no doubt that Labour would prefer, I'd say, he's on the Liberal side of the equation, so they'd be happier to have somebody like him as a Minister for Justice, because if for instance, he has to fall on the sword and sometime down the line, I personally don't think it will happen, but then you don't know who you're going to get in his place, you know? And he is obviously taking on the significant vested interests of the law library and the incorporated law society.
One of the real benefits of a commission here will be to establish simply the who knew what and when, because it is inconceivable that this went on for decades without other ministers for justice knowing, if not the detail.
Well, I heard Nora Owen the other day saying that she didn't know it, and I heard Dermot Hearn saying that he didn't know it. I mean, in some ways, maybe we're a bit unfair on ministers. They literally cannot know. They can only know what they're told, if you know what I mean.
Okay.
Like, it seems to me quite remarkable that there was that fierce long time. I mean, people are writing about it today with incredulity that that the minister only read that letter in the middle of a cabinet meeting.
We'll take this to develop that possibility. Supposing, for argument's sake, at some level within the department, and it had to be at some level, there was information about this, and we know that after the Morris Tribunal, there were questions asked in the Dáil about the prevalence of the recording of conversations between guards and members of the public from Garda stations. Now, supposing, for argument's sake, you are a senior civil servant and you get a letter saying, bring this to the minister.
Yeah.
And the minister is going to say to you, as I suspect Minister Shatter would, because his record on this subject is actually quite good, who knew about this? What is the scale of it? I can see why that letter is not something you'd be running in the door to hand over without the answers, which to me is at least a possible explanation for the delay. Because
that it was on purpose, that it was deliberate.
The civil servants would have been, I suspect, terrified to confront this minister of all ministers with something that he would instinctively say, this is wholly and completely improper. And, you know, we know that in the course of the Irish presidency of the European Council of Ministers on the justice side, our minister was to the fore in standing down. There was a measure at European level in relation to guaranteeing right of access to lawyers. And this is really important for some of the, you know, recent accession states where under the Soviet system, lawyers had pretty restricted rights of access to their clients, and those eavesdropping would have been routine. And some countries wanted to facilitate the eavesdropping and others didn't. And under the Irish presidency, the measure went through with a complete prohibition on eavesdropping. Now, it doesn't affect us because we have the opt-out on European stuff. But within the previous 12 months, Shatter was in charge of standing up to some pretty difficult traditions in relation to the integrity of lawyer-client communications. The department would have known that. The idea that you would go in and you'd say, now, just by the way, Minister, on top of your political list for this week is, we have been abusing people's constitutional rights for decades, and it's on your watch that we're going to tell it. I mean, like, in a sense of fairness, it appears to me to be, until we know the detail, until we've had the commission, wholly unfair that whether it's Martin Callanan or it's Deputy Shatter, take the rap for misconduct of decades' history.
Alan Shatter is the kind of man that would find that, from what I do know of him, apparent. He is, whether people like him or hate him, he is as straight as a die. He's not a guy who would tolerate that level of corruption. In fact, that he's scared to live in daylight out of the guards when he got the job of Minister for Justice in the first place.
Did he?
But what would this...
Did he? Tell me more.
Absolutely, because he would say, he had been involved in the Abby Lara case and other cases like that, and he would have absolutely would have said, this guy is totally anti-guard or whatever, that he won't be on our side. But when you following on from what James is talking there, but in terms of civil servants, it is significant. There's a piece in the Irish Independent, or the Sunday Independent today, about Martin Callanan being upset about that end, effectively shafted him. He says, and it's I believe it's coming directly from him, that civil servants had advised him in the Department of Justice not to apologise to the whistleblowers.
And that would they put out a statement, I heard it the other day, saying not so, not so?
Well, you see, well, I said, she said, that this is part of the thing that's happening now. But at the same time, it is on record, it is known in this country that because of legal imperatives and the way they view these cases, never admit, never apologise. Like, we're going back to, you know, the Bridget McCall case that Michael Noonan came back to haunt Michael Noonan, to destroy Fine Gael's opportunity or chances in the Dáil back in 2002, did him as leader of Fine Gael at the time as a result. And now he's back like the phoenix rising from the ashes. But the feeling is in civil service mentality, and I would agree with James that perhaps that letter came in. There's no way that we're going to go into likes of Shatter and give him this letter. By the way, there's a bomb here. We don't know where it is. We don't know how much explosives in it, but it's there, and not have an answer to it. So the civil servants, you know, cover your backside.
Since we're into conspiracy theories, that there might be some civil servants who actually would do him a disservice, because, you know, he has a particularly irascible manner sometimes, and that
I don't think so. I've spoken to a senior civil servant in his office who had said to me that he found him very easy to work with as far as, you know, getting the work done. And
getting on with it.
Culture, and the Department of Justice is a very interesting department, and I was there for 2.5-3 years. And they, I suppose, they have a kind of a tradition and a history going back to the Troubles. They were seen as the kind of bulwark against the the bombing campaign, the Provisional IRA and all this kind of thing. They have a very strong esprit de corps in the place. But to suggest...
They were also very secretive, but anyway...
Well, I think that's slightly overplayed in the media. I mean, when I was in there, there were always on, people on, oh, have you got my tape and all this kind of carry on. But the situation is, in terms of the Department of Justice officials, and I worked with them, and there are probably no finer civil servants in the country, in my opinion, but they whoever the minister is, they will serve that minister loyally. And that would apply nearly in every government department. But particularly in a place like Justice, where they would almost wrap the minister in cotton wool, in the sense that I've worked in other departments where ministers have come under pressure, and one particular case where a minister was lost overboard. And the civil servants, generally speaking, will do their best to try and to if you like, save a minister or to make sure that he
who was lost overboard?
Michael Lowry.
All right, yeah.
That was back in the distant. Yeah. It was a rainbow government, but... No, but I'm just saying that there is a process there. And, of course, Harry here is beside me, but the media, as we know, once there's a whiff of blood in the air, it's unrelenting. They will pursue, once they see a winged animal, in this case, possibly Minister Shatter, they will pursue that animal to the very end of the earth to try and get that. You know, it's like a coursing meeting. It's what they do, right? In fairness, so
are you the greyhound, Harry?
Well, I was getting my hounds. They're baying there behind me. There can be a feeding frenzy when a crisis erupts, and the media have often been portrayed as a kind of a flock of starlings, all going together in unison and going after,
which is possibly quite true.
It can be. I mean,
the herd of independent minds.
Yeah, well, I think the expression is consensus has been formed.
Consensus.
But at the same time, I mean, at least part of the issue relates. I mean, Richard gave a stout defence of the Department of Justice, but the Department of Justice, like an awful lot of other public institutions, has this kind of concept of unruined dangan, which it inherited from the British civil servant. And there has been a reluctance on the part of the Department of Justice particularly, but also other government departments, to be transparent and open in terms of sharing information. And there has been a tendency to secrecy within the Department of Justice in particular that probably hasn't done the Department of Justice any good in the long term. I think there is a need to look at the manner in which our government institutions work and the way in which they share information with the citizens. And I think the citizen is entitled to far more information from the Department of Justice.
Yeah, but the freedom of information people are permanently trying to work their way around.
Well, the Gardaí haven't been subject to it, and Brendan Howland's reforms will allow some access to information from the Gardaí, but only on the administrative side. And there is an argument to be made on a case-to-case. One of the difficulties with the guards, and Paul was referring to it in our private conversation beforehand, is that the commissioner has a dual function. He's the head of the police force, but he's also the head of national security. And one of the difficulties in getting official information from the Gardaí is this national security role. And I think there could be some kind of means or manner in which information that doesn't touch on national security could be released, because there's a blanket ban on all information coming from the Gardaí.
Just before I leave, I have to take a break, Paul. There has been talk about it'll be an open competition for the job. Presumably the senior people in there are going to go for it. There was also talk about the possibility of a layperson.
I would find it, based on the fact that it, part of the remit of the Gardaí is to state security, I would think they would find it difficult to bring in an outsider as a foreigner or somebody who from another agency or another. I think it would be probably repugnant to them. By the way, there's one net effect of all of this controversy, and that is that the Gardaí are practically in a state of managerial paralysis at the moment. You have a acting commissioner who's an excellent lady, and perhaps this is certainly not the way she would have wanted to even find herself in the hot seat, Noreen O'Sullivan. But she's now doing three jobs. She's now doing there are two deputies. She's covering those two portfolios. In the current state of paralysis that exists in the government, they're not going to rush to replace the Garda Commissioner, whether it's with Noreen O'Sullivan, who would be more than capable of doing the job, or somebody else. So that's going to hold up for a couple of months. What's going to happen in the meantime? Because you now have a situation, and this is something that I find very critical about the Guards. You have a civil service mentality has seeped into the Guards over the past 10 or 15 years, particularly ever since the early noughties when Michael McDougall was there. And it's all cover your arse. Let's not make any decisions. Let's not do anything. Let's demur from making decisions. I know a case, anecdotally, of a senior Garda who was on duty in his district, and a very serious criminal incident occurred, and he disappeared, quite literally, on his junior ranks, and they had to deal with this situation. Why? Because if it went pear-shaped, he was going to be in trouble, and it wouldn't look good for his promotion points, his prospects.
Simple as that.
And that is something that we should have to change here with an independent police authority.
Okay, can I come back to you? Can you hold that thought? Because I have to take a break, and I'll be back with us in studio this morning. Paul Williams, Catherine McGuinness, Harry McGee, Richard Moore and James McGill.
1850 715 150.
Welcome back to the programme. Richard Moore, you wanted to come in there.
I was just on the previous discussion about the new Garda Commissioner. This will be the first occasion where normally it's filled by the ranks, but the government have made a decision that they're going to throw it open internationally. So therefore, if you're the Deputy Chief Constable of Somerset and Navan Police or whatever, I presume you can apply for the job. Now, I think the Department of Justice obviously would prefer if it was an in-house person, but the government may take a decision that, look, we need to make fundamental changes to the way the Guards are managed. And just as a by, and not for any particular reason, but I was at an event on Friday. There's a group called the Association of European Journalists, and it was addressed by Judith Gillespie, who's the Deputy Chief Constable. It was her last day in the job in Dublin. It was their Deputy Chief Constable of the PSNI, and she was asked a question during the question and answer session. Was she interested in taking over the job
gig in
Dublin? And she did her, whatever. Noreen O'Sullivan's a friend of mine, this kind of thing. But then she didn't rule it out, which I thought was very, very strange. And she couldn't apply for the job, the PSNI job, the top job in PSNI, to replace Matt Baggett, because under some small little clause in the Good Friday Agreement, you had to serve 2 years in another police force outside the jurisdiction of the North. So she actually couldn't get that job. There's a certain kind of view that she ticks all the bills. She's actually because she'd be familiar with police authorities and the way the Ombudsman's Office operates in the North. She'd have close links with the Guards.
Yeah.
I hope I'm not delivering a CV for her. But she also speaks Irish as well. She's learned Irish, and she's from a Protestant background. Yes. Speaks Irish, and a curious one when she didn't rule it out.
Well, it would be interesting to have a woman, because now you have the Chief Justice, the Attorney General, the DPP, the Chief State Solicitor, and now the Head of the Guards. All women.
Did you ever think you'd see the day?
Did I ever think I'd see the day? Certainly.
But Noreen Sullivan would take a lot of the boxes as well. She was in crime and security, which is state security.
Yeah.
Agent, the difficult one. She was in HR. She was in a regional position. She was, and she's been a deputy commissioner in charge of operation. And before that, she was in drugs, and she's been right through the mill. And I think it's quite unfortunate that she finds herself in the hot seat at this time. And one must point out, her name has not come up in relation to any of these controversies. In fact, a lot of people would feel in Garda headquarters that a road was built around her, because she has fought a very, very difficult job to get. It is a male dominated, misogynist organisation, and she has had a difficult, dogged career trying to get up through a man's world. And because you're a woman in that world, if you're ambitious,
so you need
then
to be
you're
tough.
There are some much more disparaging than
I think there are definitely straws in the wind that the government may decide, here, now's our chance, let's look outside. And just as you say, she's a woman as well. I'm just saying that they may decide to go outside. I think it's unfortunate for Noreen O'Sullivan.
James, do you want to come in?
But just to say that, I mean, obviously an international aspect of the competition is to be welcomed to get the very best candidate. But whether it's Acting Commissioner O'Sullivan or anybody other internal candidates, nobody should be penalised for the sins of the fathers, unless we're going to apply exactly the same criterion to applicants from Somerset, Navan and any of the other police forces, all of whom have their fair share of skeletons. I'm pretty sure. I mean, you don't have to be a detailed student of Irish history to point to some of the miscarriages that have occurred in the UK system, and the United States would be even worse.
Can I just mention, Marion, there's a story by Fionnán Sheehan, my colleague, in the Sunday Independent today, which I think is excellent. He says, you know, as the coalition degenerates into a rabble, maybe we should invite the Troika back. He maintains that this all we've got into this mess because we were so used to the Troika keeping a close eye on us that we've just fallen apart with the excitement of them going. But on top of that as well, one other issue somebody mentioned to me recently in the pub. He said, for the past 2 months, all the public narrative has been about whistleblowers, GSOC. Now, were they not bugging phones on a systemic level? There is not a mention of austerity. There is not a mention of economics. There is not a mention of... We must be completely
funny you
out
should
of
say that.
We must what be out the, of austerity now. Completely
the caller
out of
was on to say the tapes issue is obviously to distract us away from Kenny plus Shatter. Plus, it's an issue that both can claim has nothing to do with them, but they're fixing it. It's all a ball of smoke, says our caller here. Another one said, did the Taoiseach overreact instead of waiting for the outcome of a working group? Callan and not without fault, says another. Remember the whistleblowers. I think it is now emerging that the Garda Síochána were allowed to become a law unto themselves. There was a reluctance, or indeed a fear, to interfere with the Gardaí, and this was accepted and didn't really worry Irish society. Now all this is about to change.
I think actually Richard talks about what Richard said about Brian Dowling's point about a commission of inquiry, and there is some evidence to suggest that the reaction might have been a Pavlovian reaction, that it might have been that the details of the Ian Bailey case might have spooked the government into taking a very presumptive action. With commissions of investigation, what usually happens is that they appoint a senior counsel or somebody to become an investigation officer who will look into the facts and will compile a report on a private basis, a scoping exercise, as it were. And on the basis of that, the government might then decide to establish a commission of investigation under the 2005 legislation. But what's happened here is that they've done away with all that kind of preliminary groundwork, as it were, and within the space, it wasn't even 48 hours, it was 48 minutes that they decided that they were going to form a commission of investigation. I think James is going to say that it's necessary, and I probably...
You can't say it now, James, because I'm over my time for the news. So again, as I would say, hold that thought. We're now going to the newsroom and Susan Jackson.